Maybe not.
That said, he said it with the bowl.
I'd like to call the meeting to order. This is the State Government Committee, Conference Committee. And for those of you that haven't been to a previous one, let me give you a little bit of background. The House and the Senate have both passed bills with regard to finance for state government agencies and departments. And this committee now is charged with the responsibility of ironing out any differences that there may be between the House version of the bill and the Senate version. We had a meeting the other day at which time we went through and looked at the items that were identical or very similar. We worked our way down the list, and we agreed to most of them. We only deferred action on one because we needed some additional information. Today, the plan is to focus on those items where there are some significant differences between the House and the Senate version. That is to say that both the House and the Senate have passed some language that relates to that issue, but there are some differences, significant differences in language or approach. The next time we meet, the committee will be focused on those items where one of the bodies has provision and the other does not. And so what we'll be looking at is one body trying to convince the other that should be included, and that will be the next step. And the fourth main area of action for this committee will be related to the budget. We are waiting for the targets, that is to say, what is the amount of money that we will have to work with as a committee as we resolve our bill. And at this point, that's being worked on. We don't know as of yet when that might come to us. What happens there is the leadership of the House and the Senate confer, and they come to an agreement about what the target ought to be for each of the committees, plus a target for all of state government. And so we really can't get into the whole issue of budget or money until we know what our target, what we're trying to achieve, what our goal will need to be as a committee. So I wanted to explain that to everybody so you understand the process. And we will continue with our meeting next week, and the schedule will depend upon when we get our targets, and then we'll be able to hopefully wrap up our deliberations. With that, Senator Perry is actually chairing today, but he's presenting a bill in a committee, and so he's been delayed. And I'm Maury Lanning, chair of the House committee, and I will just fill in for him until he is able to get back from his committee hearing. And what we will do, if it's all right with members of the committee, is to have Mr. Bodern go through piece by piece, as we did the other day, on the similar items or identical items, and have some discussion. And members and everyone, if a particular item has some significant budget implications, we may have to defer or hold off on taking final action until we know. But if there appears to be an agreement, a consensus, we can go ahead and act on that item. And just as we've done before, as we cover each of the issues, we will give an opportunity for anyone in the audience who wishes to speak to a provision in the bill. We'll give you an opportunity to come to the testifiers' table and present your concern in support of or concern about a particular provision. So, Mr. Bodern, if you want to proceed and give all of us an indication what page you're going to be on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to work from a list that's labeled Senate File 1047, language items with substantive differences. Mr. Shepard prepared this list, and I assisted him with it. It has been publicly distributed. So the first item is on page R18 of the side-by-side, and it relates to the problem gambling appropriation. The House has some additional language on its side on section 35. Basically relates to matching components. It specifies that this is these are one-time appropriations. I think otherwise, as far as the purposes for the appropriations, these are identical. And Mr. Chairman, I can move through. I'll just keep moving through these until you want
to. Well, if we can just take them one at a time, and I know someone is here to speak to this, Mr. Eppitz. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Eppitz, and members of the committee, my name is John Eppitz. I'm with the law firm of Messerly and Kramer.
And I'm Kathy Peralt. I'm the executive director of the North Star Problem Gambling Alliance.
And we were just going to speak to the differences between the House and the Senate side very quickly. The two differences are that there's a matching requirement on the House side, and it's a one-time appropriation on the House side. Neither of those two provisions exist on the Senate side. And with regard to the matching component, I think Kathy can speak to that. And if I could just speak to the appropriation side, we'd appreciate that very much.
Okay. Originally, the match language had been included in our past appropriation. And this year, when it came into the Senate, that particular piece was eliminated and continued in the House. We've come to some agreements with the Gambling Control Board on recognition of some in-kind donations that will make sure that our match funding is adequately documented. So we're very comfortable with continuing the match funding language as it is in the House side, if that's appropriate for what the committee decides. We think that was an issue that was been resolved.
And Mr. Chairman, with regard to the other... Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With regard to the other provision, the one-time appropriation, that's a sort of a legacy statement that's been in this bill, I think the last three or four biennia that I've helped this organization kind of come forward with this. I think Mr. Shepard could even speak to that. But eliminating that would make it a bit easier for North Star Problem Gambling to plan forward, because it would be an appropriation that was built into the base of the lottery. They would have to anticipate this as an expense that they would have to carry forward. You would still have to appropriate that. It would come to you as an appropriation. But it would make it easier for everybody, seeing as I think North Star has basically established a track record now of over about 6 or 8 years of being able to do this, to build it into the lottery's base, if you will. Let's kind of split the baby here.
Okay, questions from committee members. Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I carried this legislation on the Senate side, and so I believe in this. I think it's important. But I do have to say that I do not have a problem with the House language as far as one-time appropriations. That does not mean that we won't be doing it the following years. I think we very well probably would, but I'm a big fan of sunsets, and so I prefer the House language.
Mr. Chairman, could I just respond once quickly?
Mr. Eppitz?
Having it on, and I certainly do appreciate Senator Gazelka's position, building it into the base, though, makes it a sort of a budget, makes it an item that the lottery can plan for, North Star can plan for, and the and you folks can plan for, as a matter of fact. Bringing a bill every year means we inject into everybody's budget an amount of money, whether it's $250,000 or whatever it might be on an annual basis. And this would smooth out that train, if you will, going forward. On the other hand, I certainly understand Mr. Gazelka's position, but just want to bring that to your attention.
Further question, comment from anyone? What's the pleasure of the committee? Would someone care to move?
Mr. Chair,
Senator Gazelka.
I'll move that we adopt the House language 13.23 through 14.9.
Senator Gazelka moves the House language for...
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Bonner?
I think all you need to do is adopt Section 35 on the House side. The additional lines referenced by Senator Gazelka are not related to that, so just...
Just testing you,
just
Mr.
adopt
Chair.
Section 35 on the House side.
Okay, the motion is to adopt Section 35 on the House language. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. That is adopted. The next item, Mr. Bodden.
So, Mr. Chairman, it's on R19, and this is... This relates to the general reduction to agency budgets that the Commissioner of Management and Budget is directed to implement. This is necessary in order to provide a savings within the budget, and the House and the Senate have similar language. Obviously, the dollar amounts are different, but in addition to that, the instructions to the Commissioner of Management and Budget are there are some significant differences. The first would be that on the Senate side, the general fund reduction in the appropriations to agencies also includes the judicial branch. The House does not. And the House also specifically exempts Minnesota State Colleges and Universities from the definition of executive branch. So it's not included within that general instruction. And then these savings, both on both sides, are directed to come from, to the extent possible, other items within the bill, and those items are listed in a general manner in the clauses that follow. A couple small differences in those items on line 15.4 on the Senate side, it references salary and benefit changes. The benefit change there that's being referred to is changes in state employee health insurance. The House does not include that. The House has an additional clause 4 that relates to the consolidation of executive branch information technology systems. There are minor differences, I think, in the wording of the final clause, but they're quite similar otherwise. The Senate directs that the reductions made by the Commissioner of Management Budget would become reductions to agency-based budgets for fiscal years 2014 and 2015, and also provides language that calls for a report to the chairs and ranking minority members of legislative finance committees. The Senate also goes a little farther and provides direction to make a reduction to the legislative budget. This amount here relates to, again, specifically the benefit change that's on the Senate side, the health insurance changes, and it calls for advance notice of that reduction to the Legislative Advisory Commission. The other, I think, well, one important thing in understanding how this is implemented is that to the extent the items that are specifically listed here do not reach the dollar amount that is listed in this language, the direction is given to the Commissioner of Management Budget to make additional reductions to the agencies described on both on the House and Senate side. I think that's it for major differences, and I should have said earlier, if Mr. Shepard has anything he wants to contribute or add, he should feel free to interrupt me or however he wants to do that.
He's shaking his head no.
And Mr. Chairman, you know, that's what I have to say about it. I think, again, because this is an instruction to the Commissioner of Management Budget, it might be useful to hear from the agency
yes,
on how they would interpret it.
We will hear from him first. With respect to the last point, clarify for me what, if any, differences there are between the House and Senate provision with regard to the process or how the Commissioner of Management and Budget is to go about making those contingency actions if necessary.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's basically the same
okay.
on both sides. I just wanted to highlight that for you.
Okay.
Basically, it's discretion to make these cuts within those agencies. And obviously, as I suggested first, on the Senate side, that would extend to judicial branch agencies as well. On the House side,
okay.
would not.
Commissioner Showalter. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name, for the record, is Jim Showalter. Commissioner of Management and Budget. As to the provisions that were just described, I would offer extreme concerns over the ability to implement them and ultimately the impacts on state government if we were actually to successfully find a way to do so. The impact is multiple. It is both a financial set of instructions as well as an FTE set of instructions, the interactions of which are at best difficult to interpret and understand, and ultimately the effects are fairly far-reaching. This isn't just a MMB issue. This is certainly a state government issue. This is the enterprise of the state of Minnesota type of issue because of the magnitude of savings that are attempted to be achieved here and also the impacts of what would happen if we failed to do so. If I could, Mr. Chair, just offer a couple of specific concerns. We have tried to estimate some of the impacts on state agencies, but understand and would expect that that is an ongoing discussion, understanding where this legislative staff are helping us understand what the intent of the language is. But even with our first cut at this, we've talked with our colleagues at other agencies, and they are also here to help give you some understanding of the impact of this level of reduction. First, on the financial side, the estimate that we have is that between the provisions on both the House and Senate side, for a variety of different reasons, that the estimate of across-the-board impact is roughly 10%. So then any general fund operating budget would be reduced by 10%, regardless of what's put into the bill of its origination as direct appropriations. As an example, the Department of Agriculture has had a bill that has been signed, enacted into law, that had some general fund reductions. This bill would put an additional 10% reduction, or up to a 10%, perhaps more, but it would certainly have a substantial impact on the operating budget of that agency as well as the FTE counts. That is a simple example of the impacts that would occur through direct services in some of our state agencies, as well as support services in other places. So, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to talk some more about this and give you some more details about it, but I'll just pause for a second in case there's specific issues before I go on.
Well, Commissioner Showalter, I think it's important for people to understand that what you're talking about is a worst-case contingency plan that we have put together budgets in both the House and the Senate with what we believe to be reasonable projections as to what could be saved, what could be spent with regard to the areas over which we have responsibility. And I know that you folks don't agree with some of our projections. You don't agree with our estimates as to what might be achieved by way of savings or by way of increasing revenues. We have to respectfully disagree about that. But people need to understand that we had to build into these bills a provision that what if we're wrong? And if we're wrong, you have to have a way of obviously balancing the budget. And so that's why we have these provisions that would then enable the administration, through your leadership in management and budget, to determine just how you would meet any shortfall that there is. I know and understand that you don't like that. You don't want that to be the case. I respect that. I certainly hope that something like that would not have to occur. But I get concerned about sending out signals to everybody who's dependent on state government now, all state agencies, that they can expect a 10% reduction on top of what we have already proposed in our bills. And I think that unnecessarily alarms people. And frankly, I'm kind of disappointed that the attention that is getting. And you know, people need to understand that We all need to be aware of contingency plans. We just had another discussion in our state government finance in the House today about the need for state government contingency plans. Let me give you an example. The state of Minnesota is very dependent upon federal funds. And whether or not those federal funds are going to be there in the future like they have been in the past, I think all of us would understand is certainly a question. And so, therefore, what we were doing in committee today is saying that the state of Minnesota better do some contingency planning as to what happens if federal revenues do not materialize like they have in the past or like people might expect. And just a reaction, I guess, Commissioner, I'll give you a chance to respond to my response.
The very gracious, Mr. Chair, thank you very much. And I appreciate the concerns and observations that you made. I would just say that the 10% figure that we're discussing is, I would say, a reasonable estimate. And, in fact, there's a number of different factors that could make it worse. As Mr. Bodern walked through some of the provisions, if that we are to somehow execute at the same time, including a reduction in the number of full-time FTEs with a salary freeze while eliminating senior management, consolidating all IT operations for significant savings, and ultimately finding other things. So we're at the same time moving on all fronts, and if we aren't able to successfully execute those, there's even if we are able, there's still additional savings that are required from the across-the-board provision. The 15% reduction provision also is something that is a separate non-budgetary item in that it's requiring the reduction of FTEs, but at least my understanding of the language is that those resources also go away. To the extent they're not in the general fund, it's not like those resources and those activities get contracted out because the appropriations are shrunk. So it is not even, you know, diverting the work. It's reducing the overall size of state government, but in uncertain ways, which is part of what we would like to make sure that's clear. In addition, the timing of this is difficult because of the trigger mechanism. We are to carry off a number of different provisions, as you talked about. We'll eliminate all assistant commissioners, for instance, even though they're the people who will help us get bond funds. They're the people who manage the prisons. There are a number of different activities that are pretty critical, yet we will eliminate the senior management. And after we've done that experiment, then we will see how much savings we had. By the end of the biennium, we have to get to this target number. So the 10% figure is only if we allocated it on day one of the biennium. If we waited 6 months, 12 months, the practical impact on an agency's operating budget for fiscal year 13 could be higher. Finally, just in terms of the FTE impact and where state employees are at, I want to just be clear that most people aren't grant makers. Most people aren't in the back office. 50% of state employees are within the Departments of Corrections, Human Services, and Transportation. Again, while some of those aren't general funded, some of them are, and the impact of shrinking both the number of employees and the resources to get that job done will have impacts that I just want to make sure that the committee is aware of.
Well, Commissioner, the governor has also recommended employee reductions, and not to the same extent that our two committees have, but you've got some of the same issues at stake there, do you not?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. I think everyone understands the need for more effective, more efficient government, that the number, the resources available in this biennial budget are shrinking. This is entirely a matter of what is the instructions, the directions, the operability of it, and being very cognizant of the impacts that are about to occur. The governor made specific recommendations, and yes, he did reduce the number of FTEs. Nothing close to the scale that is proposed in just this provision that we came on today.
Commissioner, isn't it 6%?
Of general, Mr. Chair, of the general funded operations, yes. Of all funds is a smaller number. So, again, it's a question of, you know, which perspective you're taking. And, again, it's part of the confusion. It took us quite a while to understand and work through the language because it both has general fund operating reductions and different instructions on employees and basically a complement control for all funds and how they apply to each other. You know, we're still not entirely clear if the credit on one hand goes to the other hand. That's another level down. I think the overall magnitude of the impact right now is what I'd like to bring to the committee's attention.
Well, Commissioner, if there is still some confusion about what the particular language might mean here, that may be something that we better talk about. And I don't know if Mr. Bodern or Mr. Shepard are in a position to wade into this at this point. The issue that he's raising, general fund versus other funds, and how the language comes into play there. Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, members, I think, and if Commissioner Showalter understands this differently, then we should perhaps discuss it. But my understanding is on the language that Mr. Bodern has been referring to on page R19 is clearly a general fund reduction in both the House and the Senate. That reduction on the House side, for example, of $94.875 million must be reduced from the general fund. Commissioner Showalter also referred to the requirement of the bill for a 15% reduction in the number of FTE employees. That applies, I believe, to all funds. So that's my understanding, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bodern, is that your understanding?
Mr. Chairman, with reference to that last point, yeah, on R56, that's the language relating to the reduction in the state workforce. And that is aimed a 15% reduction in the number of full-time equivalent employees in the executive branch. So that would apply to all funds.
Commissioner, do you have a different understanding of the language? Or?
No, Mr. Chair, my understanding is as well that the FTE reduction is of all funds, the operating budgets and sort of the fail-safe is on the general fund. As to how they interact, there's implementation questions, but I think Mr. Shepard and Mr. Bowden said it correctly of the sources in our interpretation of those two provisions.
Well, Commissioner, if there is any confusion about the language, we'd like to clear it up. And if you have some suggestions as to how we can improve the language and making it more clear and avoiding any confusion or misunderstanding or whatever, we'd like to hear it.
Very good, Mr. Chair. We would be happy to continue communicating with staff. I think at this moment, what is important for you to understand and the committee to just understand is the scale of this. I think it is easy to think of 5%, 10%, 15% as relatively simple numbers. As each of the other committees have been looking at budgets, they've been making reductions, making recommendations, and a number of commissioners and deputy commissioners are here to help explain some of the practical implications of some of these recommendations. If it would please the chair and the committee, I would appreciate the chance to have them testify briefly.
Any further questions of the commissioner? Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, if I understand the governor's proposal, it was a 6% cut in FTEs over 2 years, and our 15% proposal is over 4 years. So if you look at the first two-year progress, they're not dramatically different. It's just what happens the third and fourth year.
Mr. Chair, Senator, this is where the funds comes to play. The general fund reduction that you referred to from the governor, is roughly 30 to 40% of the overall FTE pool. You're talking about extending that basically to all funding sources. So in terms of scale, it's more significant because you're basically saying federal funds that might be available, we wouldn't be able to go and receive because we couldn't hire the employees necessary to do the work that the federal government wants us to do. Or enterprise funds or other places that we do work, Trunk Highway Fund, where we do work, that was not affected by the governor's recommendations. In this proposal, it is.
Any further questions for the commissioner? Thank you, Commissioner. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak to this language? Okay. I understand we have other commissioners here who would like to speak probably to the same issue. Commissioner Peterson? Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ken Peterson, Commissioner, Department of Labor and Industry. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
Thank you. Members, thank you very much for allowing the opportunity to comment. We have our agency is a regulatory agency predominantly funded by fees, something like less than 2 to 3% of our overall budget comes from general fund fees, or just comes from the general fund. The balance of our funding comes from fees on various professions and trades, as well as in workers' comp, paying for operations such as OSHA and the workers' compensation regulation system. So we're not general fund, we're a regulatory agency. Many of the regulations we have been put into effect because of professions desiring protection from unscrupulous operators who may be acting in a predatory way upon the general public. That's in, trades such as plumbing, electricians, that sort of thing. So we have licensing, enforcement, inspections. Those funds, people pay the fees, we go out and inspect, and that sort of thing. And then in the workers' compensation area, we charge fees that go to insurance companies. They pay for the regulation of the system, as well as ensuring people get their checks on time, ensuring that people get back to work on time. So the problem for us becomes, if in fact you kick in the contingent items, the contingent areas you talked about, that you go beyond the general fund into the non-general fund areas, that becomes necessary, then we have to make these cuts in areas which I think the people protected, the very trades and professions which we regulate, they've asked for to be paying those things. And so it'll have no impact, very little impact on the general fund. If in fact there's the Senate bill goes into effect, MMB informs us that we will have 31 losses. We lose 31 FTEs, or the House bill goes into effect, we lose 51 FTEs. The problem with that is we only save $129,000. So we're reducing the services to people, but we're not saving the dollars we wanted that I would think would be the objective of your saving. You are reducing the size of government, but you're reducing the services which the trades and the businesses regulated have asked for. Finally, there's a perverse effect of this too. Many of these professions, such as electricians and others, they desire to be licensed, they desire to have inspections. They need that in order to keep down their insurance costs. What will happen if we're unable to provide adequate services, will take longer to do inspections, take longer to do enforcement, their insurance fees will go up. So we have this perverse effect on the one hand of cutting non-general fund, non-tax dollars, on the one hand of cutting those expenditures, but on the other hand, increasing the cost to the companies and professions involved. And that sort of concludes my testimony.
Okay, Commissioner, could you clarify for me what we have here are two things that we have to focus on. Number one, the budget proposal as it affects each department or agency. And then the second thing is that what if, in a worst-case scenario, the revenue and expenditures don't turn out the way they're projected, that there would then have to be up 10% or whatever additional. Are you speaking to both or just the additional contingency?
Mr. Chair,
10%?
Members, I'm speaking to the contingency, the second item you discussed.
Thank you. That's what we need to clarify. Yes. Because, and everybody, again, needs to understand that we have to go there only if the projections on revenue and savings do not materialize. And they may materialize in full or maybe not quite as much. And so what we're talking about here is contingency plans. That's what you're addressing.
Mr. Chair, members, yes.
Thank you. Other questions for the commissioner? Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Peterson, maybe you could just clarify for me. In your statement, you said in the House plan, you may you would reduce your full-time employees by a count of 51, and then you quantified saying that only saves $150,000. And tell me what was going into your math there, because I wasn't sure what your point was with that. The math doesn't seem there's more to it than that, and I was hoping you could explain yourself.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Stenders, it's not that we pay our people very little.
Yeah.
That the fees, these are people, if you do across the board non-general fund cuts as a contingency, as the chairman I just discussed, you kick into that's when you kick into those areas, and that's where you lose these people, but you're not saving the general funds. Does that clarify it, or am I just confusing it more?
Representative Stansrud.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you're saying your fees will be reduced.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, one final thing. I can't speak for other agencies on this. I don't think one should assume that previous administrations have run bloated governments. Since 2001, my predecessors, Labor and Industry, reduced the number of people we have in our Workers' Compensation Division by 25%. As time goes along, I intend to continue to also look at places where it can be reduced all the time. I think that any responsible agency head wants to do the same thing. In our Construction Code and Licensing Division, the last 3 years, we reduced the number of people employed there by 20%. And we'll keep looking at that, where areas you can be reduced. But I think that this idea of one size fits all, and it has to be done in a certain time period, regardless of where the source comes, as it would in the contingency plan, I don't think it works. I do think that any responsible agency manager, as well as responsible budget committees, appropriations committees, finance committees, will also be looking at those things. I don't think a one size fits all approach works.
Commissioner, I hope you understand that even if in a worst-case scenario a 10% reduction overall would need to be achieved, the administration has the ability to say to some agencies, you don't have to go to 10%. Maybe somebody has to go over. I hope you understand the way this language is put together, that we are not dictating that each and every part of the budget has to be that percentage. You
Mr.
understand?
Chairman, members, I understand that.
Thank you. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just follow up on that, I'm just curious what you made the comment one size fits all, and yet you appeared to have understood the chairman's comments. Can you explain your comment of one size fits all and your interpretation of that, and whether or not that is inconsistent with the chairman's description, which you seem to understand?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, the problem with the contingent approach is that it takes the responsibility of cutting and puts it in the executive branch as opposed to the legislative branch of how to conduct its budget. So then the executive branch is faced with the very consequential decisions of reaching beyond what the legislature may have intended in some areas and may not have intended in other areas. So then there's a temptation to apply. It would not necessarily, as you point out, it does not necessarily have to, but it would be a temptation to apply that one size fits all.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, I mean, we're getting to the nub of some issues here that frankly are a great frustration for those of us who are producing these bills and attempting to structure them in an intelligent way that allows the governor some discretion to reach some tough targets. And your comment was a one size fits all, and implying that our language required a one-size-fits-all, which it does not. And now you're reverting back to describing this as a temptation to the governor to do a one-size-fits-all. So I think those of us on the committee have tried very hard to make sure that this is well-designed and gives the governor the flexibility he needs. And the rhetoric, frankly, coming from the administration and many of the public statements and a lot of the folks who have showed up here today being riled up by this very comment, I think the administration bears some responsibility to accurately reflect what's happening here and the terminology of your testimony and the assertions and implications of what's in the bill be accurately reflected in people's statements.
Further questions? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For Commissioner Showalter, I'd like to know what statistics or data or assumptions that were made to arrive even at the 10%.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, members, excellent question. We, in fact, I think have tried to walk through the various provisions that were articulated earlier and look at basically the overall cut number that was associated with those. In addition, there are across-the-board features to other appropriations, particularly in the House side, which is a backup provision to some of the revenue-producing provisions, federal offset, tax analytics, I believe. The Senate provision has a much broader reduction to state employee compensation through the high deductible proposal. Basically, pulling those together, looking at the overall impacts of those, and then taking into account a couple of exclusions that are also provided in the bill. There was no provision made for the estimated layoff costs, things like that, severance packages, which also end up both being authorized and are necessary as to the extent that layoffs occur. So there's no provision of that within the estimates. So that basically gets us to the estimate of the impact. This is also over a biennial period. So while the dollar savings are supposed to be achieved over this two-year period, the 10% is assuming that it occurs July 1. If, in fact, say, half of the savings are achieved through the various instructions and we realize that in year two, you'd still be at a 10% figure. So the timing of this is also sensitive. We basically spread it over the entire biennium.
Representative Benson.
With all due respect, Commissioner, at best that was incomplete. And when we come before a committee, we have to have a fiscal note in order to back some of those assumptions up. But you're ready, and as is testimony with other commissioners, to say it's 10% as a contingency needed. So I think it's a worthy discussion. However, I prefer that when we have these discussions that we could back them up with something a little bit more concrete.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Showalter, maybe I didn't fully understand your comments, and you're referring perhaps just to your own internal calculations on how you'd achieve these additional savings if you couldn't realize the savings prescribed in the bill. But I know in the fiscal note for the 15% workforce reduction, I believe we're carrying about, I may be wrong, I'm asking for the fiscal note, but I thought it was like a $30 million number for severance costs. The bill intends and tries to lay out a scenario where the bulk of all of that workforce reduction would be realized through attrition and through early retirement incentives, in which case you wouldn't have any layoff severance costs. So I just want to make sure I'm understanding. Are you describing some additional calculations that we haven't seen fiscal notes on? Because I know the fiscal note you gave us, which I personally would disagree with, carries a significant cost, and we have included those severance costs in our budgets.
No, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, excellent question, and that gets into the very specifics of trying to estimate this, because there are multiple assumptions and multiple proposals that are all wrapped into the across-the-board direction to the Commissioner of MMB. In the instance that you talked about, you're right. There are some of those things. There's also not an appropriation for some of those costs, but that's more of a technical issue of, you know, what's the net number to be. Ultimately, The impact here is an estimate. And the question of fiscal notes is a good one because, in fact, that is, you know, part of – we're trying to give you at least the impact of the fail-safe here. We understand there's a disagreement about the likelihood of being able to save you know, take the example of eliminating assistant commissioners, that there's – that work is somehow not going to be done, or that that the workforce issue right now is that we – that these are somehow going to get us to a place where the workforce is in better shape and more efficient and better able to accomplish the tasks. The fail-safe is probably necessary. There's just a lot of disruption and a lot of issues that occur as we try to pull this off. And so, you know, ultimately, we try to give you that estimate. This is not a fiscal note. It is a opportunity for you to understand the across-the-board impact of this. I quite well understand that across the boards sound relatively simple, but they tend to have far-reaching impact, and that is what we're trying to help communicate to the committee today.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I'm super clear on all that, but just a couple of maybe specific questions. So the fiscal notes that you provided, and I'm again, I don't have them in front of me. I'm operating from memory. For the 15% overall four-year workforce reduction, if I'm remembering right, had $30 million of severance costs in it. Am I right in remembering that you did include severance costs in the fiscal note on our original bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that's right. I don't believe, however, there are severance costs included in, say, the $95 million unallocated cut on the House side, or are there severance costs included in some of the other estimates. So, you know, I your point is well taken. To the IT consolidation, that is one particular fiscal note. We can certainly continue to work on fine-tuning these numbers. But, you know, in the end, I think I don't want to lose the forest for the trees in saying that there's broad impact here and want the committee to be aware of that.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just another follow-up then. So as we're talking about this additional reduction that would occur if you weren't able to realize all of the savings from some of the proposals. Are you saying that you are assuming in that and across the board cut that that's what how the administration would approach it is in an across the board way?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not telling you that that's a decision. Certainly this isn't even before the governor. It hasn't, you know, you're working through the provisions right now. That is certainly one direction. As you said earlier, this is a flexibility provision. That would be one way of implementing it. Hopefully that would help you understand the magnitude of the changes and savings that would be required to reach the fiscal estimates that are booked here.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Showalter. I want to be super clear because there has been a lot more heat than light generated around this topic by the administration and, frankly, by virtue of the fiscal notes. And the comments that have been made so far since I've been here appear to me to be a bit of a smokescreen, frankly. And the fact that the administration creates these across-the-board cut expectations, let's be clear, that is not – in the language of our bill. If that's the governor's direction and that's the going-in assumptions that you want to make about how you would accomplish this, fair enough, then take ownership of that in terms of that would be the governor's strategy. Don't, through your comments and discussions and complicated, intertwined discussions about fiscal notes, somehow imply that there's an across-the-board cut in our bill or that somehow we have neglected to consider severance costs in our bill. Neither of those two are true. And the people sitting in this room who are all concerned about what's going to happen to them and their critical priority functions, I think are victims of the smokescreen coming out of the executive branch and anybody paying attention clearly to the language in our bill would not draw those inferences. Do we have a lot of conversation and discussions about how to get to the end result that we're all looking to accomplish here, and that's a negotiated solution? Absolutely. Will that solution consist of maybe some combination of severance and different kinds of cuts? Absolutely. but the comments that come out for public consumption appear to be far more political and way less oriented towards a collaborative resolution of these issues, and I think it's causing a real problem in our ability to get to a solution.
Commissioner, did you wish to respond?
If I may, Mr. Chair, thank you. I appreciate, Representative, your concerns and the heated nature of this, and that is in part because of the broadness and the size of the instructions that are here. My understanding on page R19 is that the Commissioner of Management and Budget must reduce appropriations for executive and judicial branch agencies by $302 million. That one way or another, we are to execute that. That is the Senate position. On the House position, it is by $94,875,000. In addition to that, there are additional provisions in which we must reduce appropriations should certain things not occur or not occur into the magnitude that you are estimating. That is the instruction, and understand that you're giving us some tools. I understand that we have differences in estimates of the impact of those tools. But ultimately, it is an important that what is in this legislation and what the writer or the provision that's up right now is instructing me to make those changes. And since many of our employees are in particular areas that I don't think the legislature is instructing us to necessarily reduce, but maybe we will have to figure out an interpretation. But, you know, whether that is in whether it's in security or in internal controls or all kinds of different activities, I can make good arguments and understand you wouldn't necessarily want to be reducing those. I understand that that's where a lot of the employees of the state are right now. And so the interaction between the FTEM reduction and the funding reduction has a sizable in impact, and I'm trying to make sure that you understand that as you look at this language.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Showalter, I appreciate that and thank you, because I think what you just said and what you just described is perfectly reasonable, and that is the discussion and the process that we need to go through. I'm guessing that the vast majority of people in this room and who are communicating with us have not heard that very reasonable and rational collaborative discussion. They're here because the political message being propagated is that everybody's getting whacked across the board. And that's the kind of political rhetoric that I think needs to stop so that we can actually have a reasoned discussion here in this conference committee so these people can all realize that we're trying to shoot for the same target in a collaborative way. And I just wish the rhetorical political side of this would stop, and the smokescreen language and all of the discussions about fiscal notes and things not adding up, none of which are true, would fade into the distance. They can be in the rearview mirror. They can be part of the heat part of our process and not the light shedding part of our process. And let's move forward with that kind of an understanding together that we got a lot of work to do, a lot of details to pick through, and that's exactly the conversation we should be having, and that's exactly what should be getting communicated to the public.
Commissioner, again, I would say we welcome any constructive suggestions that you or your colleagues may have as to how we can address your concerns. But obviously we have a big challenge ahead of us here. Commissioner, any further questions for Commissioner Peterson? Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And I will turn the gavel now over to our chair for the day, Senator Perry.
Thank you, Representative Lanning. We'll proceed here, Commissioner Austin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Paul Austin. I'm the commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency. And in light of this most recent conversation, I'd like to offer the following perspective on my comments. If, in fact, the 10% is not across the board, and it could be less than that or more than that, please view my comments around an estimate of 10% as an average impact of what could occur to my agency. Because if, in fact, that is true, I could perhaps get a 5% cut, which would be half of the scenario I'm going to lay out, or I could have a 20% cut, which would be twice as big as the scenario I'm going to lay out. So I think it's very helpful to think of this 10% scenario that we're talking from as an average impact. There's still clearly some dispute about the level of contingency or the probability of contingency. That's a conversation that will carry on. But I just want to reflect on the impacts of the cuts that are stacking or potentially stacking from across the hall with the environment bill that's being conferred right now and the two cuts that we're talking about in this committee at this point. Just as a reminder, the mission of the agency has three big pieces, and I'm going to come back to these toward the end. First one is to get Minnesotans to take responsibility for keeping the environment clean. Minnesotans do that, and they do it really, really well. You won't need my agency. That would be a wonderful future state to reach. The second is that we're supposed to protect the air, land, and water. That's what most people associate with the work that we do. And the third is that we have to operate our agency as best we can, as most efficiently, as most effectively, all those business conditions that all of us strive for every day. Clearly, we're all expecting budget cuts. Clearly, efficiency in operations is a big deal and something that we're paying very close attention to. Depending on how you look at these cuts across the House and the Senate, in this stacking scenario that I just described earlier, we're looking at somewhere between 59 and 94 FTEs in reduction. This would take our FTE count to roughly 850 plus or minus 20, depending on which side of the ledger the final number falls on. Those numbers are interesting. I think a more interesting number is the staff hours that represents. That represents somewhere between 120,000 to 195,000 staff hours. That means that my agency will have that many fewer hours to implement House File 1, to implement the governor's executive order. Already with the conditions that we're anticipating in the Environment Committee, we're anticipating about a 10% drop-off in our effectiveness rate in turning permits within the goals that were in House File 1. Clearly, that could drop to 15% or 20%, depending on if this is a 5 or 10 or 20% if we need to move to this contingency. This is clearly a problem. It's a problem for the agency. It's because we have a lot of customers who want us to move. It will be a compounded problem, assuming the economy recovers, because our current success rate is based on actually slower economic activity than all of us would hope for. So that's a contingency that we have to plan for in face of this potential reduction in capacity. If you go back a couple years to 2008 and you compare the potential at the downstream side of this contingency with the peak of 966 FTEs, we're down somewhere between 200,000 to 288,000 staff hours. That's significant. Will we hit the floor cutting 200,000 staff hours out from our agency? I don't know. We will look to technology. We will look to internal efficiency. We will look to things like preventing pollution so people don't have to come to us for permitting. But at some point, we will hit a bottom here, and that will not work well for us. I mentioned that this does run a countercurrent to our hopes on the business efficiency side. Thinking about this notion of pollution prevention and Minnesotans taking care of the environment, every single external constituency I have been talking to, business community, advocacy community, and just citizens are asking for more technical assistance from my agency. If I have to cut these kinds of hours out of our budget, it will be harder to deliver that kind of technical assistance, and then the end result will be I will have more people coming to my agency for permits, which is not a desired outcome. And lastly, these kinds of cuts in hours will reduce our ability to anticipate future challenges. There's a huge future liability looming. In 2014, 2015, there's a very, very high probability, I would say higher than 90%, that the metro area will be found in non-attainment for ozone and particulate air quality standards. If that occurs, development in the metro area will stop because we will not be able to issue air permits and add new sources to a non-attainment zone for those pollutants. We need to begin working on that now. We do not have the capacity to fully deal with a non-attainment scenario. Cuts going into the face of that kind of an ongoing project will be a challenge, to say the least. And the last, we have simple old school problems that are still out there. Right now, there's about 250,000 households in greater Minnesota that still burn their garbage. The plastic that's in that garbage is creating dioxins when they burn it. Dioxins continue to come up as a major risk for adult health in this state. So that's another old problem that we aren't done with yet. And those are the kind of capacities that we feel we will not have if we get into a scenario where we're cutting this level within our agency. Thank you for your time. I appreciate the task you have in front of you. It is not simple. It is very complicated. I appreciate all of that, and I appreciate the chance to state our concerns with our agency's budget. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Do we have any questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Hassan, or Austin, I don't know how you pronounce your name, but how many FTEs do you have totally in your agency?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the current FTEs are about 927, give or take seasonal workers. We get up to about 950 during the summer.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how many vacancies do you have presently in your organization?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, currently we have virtually none. We have some turn in the agency of approximately 30 to 40 FTEs in a given year. But because we've been managing budget cuts over the last decade largely, the vacancy rate has dropped. If you look through historical literature on the agency, you'll see talk about an 1,100 FTE ceiling. That was at a point in time where there were a number of vacancies that were sitting out there, but we clearly aren't at that place any longer.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Commissioner, how many of those full-time FTEs have you figured that you have to have to meet all the bare necessities of what your operation is called for as far as your mission?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, when I look at this non-attainment issue, the answer is more than 927. And I mean that in all candor. This non-attainment issue is an air quality issue the size of which this state has not faced. The water quality issues which we are working on have not changed. We are able and are actively reducing the size of our landfill work group because that is a program that is coming to a close. Hazardous waste management has been very stable, but if we do get an economic boom, which we all certainly hope for, we'll have a challenge with that going forward.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, the mission, I'm sure part of your mission is that you have federal law that you have to abide by. And I'm wondering what percentage of your overall that mandates that you have to do is federal.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I would have a hard time giving you an exact percent. It is extraordinarily high. I would say upwards of 80%, maybe 85%. I say that because we essentially implement the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, RCRA, some other components of the Hazardous Waste Acts, and the state pieces of those regulatory actions that stack on top of the federal acts are, quite frankly, quite minimal.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just given a note here that says that you have about 25 full-time employees in your communications department. Is that correct,
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, that's correct. The communications folks are spread out across our agency. They do not act as a conventional communications work group. Our agency is structured a bit different. They deal an awful lot with citizen outreach that is part of the permitting and regulatory process, part of the Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, again, those types of requirements.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Commissioner, how many of those could you do without?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't have an answer here today, and I think that's an answer that can only be given in the context of a final budget. Currently, we have 8 divisions. If we end up with budget cuts at this level, we might not have 8 divisions when we're done. So I would not hazard a guess at the state of that issue.
Commissioner, what you're telling this committee is that you have not even looked at potential decisions that you have to make based on what you have seen the last 6 to 8 weeks
Mr. Chair, that is not what I said.
That is exactly what you say.
Mr. Chair, I completely disagree. I said I cannot tell Representative Anderson if I'm going to cut 3 or 8 or 27 of the communications staff. You can rest assured we are looking at budget scenarios dealing with these cuts. That is something we deal with day in and day out within the agency, and our fiscal staff are looking at it. Final resolution, we aren't there yet. We are far from the end.
Representative Anderson,
thank you.
Are there any other questions for the commissioner, Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, are there any other cities that have reached that non-attainment issue in the nation that you can describe what happened there?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, absolutely. The closest one is Milwaukee. And when a city is declared in non-attainment, there's an analysis that's made of the air quality. There's a geographic region that is established where that air quality is jeopardized. That region and then the contiguous area around it as a contributing source to the air quality of that region has to go through an extensive planning and mitigation exercise where they attempt to reduce air pollution sources. In the case of ozone and particulates that we're looking at, the sources are not point sources. They're not big smokestacks. So you're left with dealing with things like traffic, land use planning, area sources like strip malls, light industrial. It's a much more diffuse exercise. There's a formal plan that goes into place that it's an agreement between the state and EPA. And there are timelines and milestones that the state would need to make to bring the state back into compliance. We were almost in this place in the late 90s, largely driven by traffic in some of the metro areas. If you recall, the testing stations for cars that were implemented in the metro area were a piece of that work to get us back down below those air quality standards. It could be something as simple as that. It could be something much more complex, which is what we're anticipating, quite frankly.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one follow-up then. Did in Milwaukee, did construction and everything stop, or were they then, they gave them time to adapt and make changes?
Commissioner Austin.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, there was a combination of both. It doesn't put an absolute stop. That is, there's a contingency depending on whether this plan makes some sense, how fast the plan can move. But there certainly have been cases. There are a number of cities across the nation who have been in this state. There have been places where there's at least been a moratorium on adding new air sources, if not a formal stop in permit issuance.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further questions of Commissioner Austin? Thank you,
Commissioner. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Introduce yourself, Commissioner.
Senator, Mr. Chairman, Chairman Perry, and Chairman Lanning, great to be here. I'm Dave Fredrickson, the Commissioner of Agriculture. It's good to be back in the old agricultural hearing room again. Minnesota Department of Ag's budget process went very well this past year, despite major challenges facing our state. We understood the need to streamline. We actually started that process before budget negotiations began. We merged two divisions to boost efficiency at the Department of Agriculture. We cut 5% of our operating costs without cutting services. The governor and the legislature cut another 10% from our base. However, we're grateful for the cooperative approach of the Senate and the House committees in developing our omnibus ag appropriations bill this past year. The budget bill was good news for Minnesota agriculture. It allowed the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to continue the important work in areas like food safety, areas like export, and development of our ag economy across the state. As the committee chairs, both Chair Magnus and Chair Hamilton noted, it would and should and could be a model for other budget areas. But the government operations bill, which you're working on here today, would eliminate many of the important programs funded under our new ag appropriations bill. The 15% agency staff cut would come on top of the cuts that we've sustained at the department this year. These cuts, I feel, would seriously impact Minnesota's ag and rural economy as a whole in many ways, but at root would certainly hamper our trade development as a key point in the emergence of China and Vietnam in terms of new markets that are becoming available to Minnesota farmers. It would possibly eliminate services that we provide to create good paying jobs in rural Minnesota. Example would certainly be the biofuels industry. The budget that was signed into law last month for the Minnesota Department of Ag made responsible cuts, I believe, but still supported the important functions of trade development and job creation. I want to share with you some detail of the impact a 15% full-time equivalency cut would have on the agency. It would, in effect, end any trade mission work that we've been involved in the past and look forward to continuing to be involved in the future. It would certainly put a stop to our renewable fuels initiative and set Minnesota back significantly in the heated race to capture the emerging next generation biofuels market. It's not a good idea to do that, particularly when we're looking at the price of gas being close to $4 today. The bill that we're looking at today would in no doubt end our pest control work, as pests likely the newly arriving emerald ash borer and others that can devastate part of our ag economy. I want to raise the issue of a new threat, but I am reluctant to do so because it would cause us to chuckle a little bit, but maybe that's what we need about this time, and that's the emergence of the new threat, the stink bug, which could be very difficult on our soybean growers across Minnesota. It would, without a doubt, eliminate our Ag in the Classroom program, a main program for building ag literacy in Minnesota. And in our last ag budget, we created the opportunity to hire an ag professional or a professional teacher to come in and help develop curriculum for school districts across Minnesota to continue the important ag literacy work that we have done in the past and continue to hope to do in the future. One in five jobs in Minnesota is in the ag and food industry. Ag literacy education, of course, is needed to build the workforce of tomorrow so we can keep these good-paying rural-based jobs in Minnesota. It also could eliminate our Minnesota Grown program. Our livestock development and dairy profitability initiatives would go by the wayside. Our grazing and land use planning assistance would go by the wayside. Our integrated pest management could very likely go by the wayside. Seed potato inspection would very likely go, and research on design of drainage systems to improve water quality. And also our newly created meat inspection program. Eliminating this program would pull a rug out of from under dozens of state-inspected meat processors around the state who expanded their small business and added jobs with the expectation that the state of the state inspection service from Minnesota Department of Agriculture, which is equal to the federal program, and that's what we'll operate under. All of these programs would likely end under a 15% reduction in work staff, either because they're funded through the state's general fund or because they are not mandated by federal and state law. The 15% cut would not occur, certainly, in a vacuum. Truth is, many state agencies, Minnesota Department of Ag included, has already seen reductions prior to the start of the 2011 legislative session. In fact, the Minnesota Department of Ag, over the past decade, similar to other agencies, have reduced our staff, in this case, a 20% reduction from 486 full-time equivalents to about 388 today. We still manage to provide a tremendous amount of service to farmers and ag communities across the state. Certainly, growing up on a farm and spending most of my life out there, I learned that when there's hard work to be done, everyone has to pitch in. And I think, Mr. Chairman, that at this point in time, Minnesota Department of Agriculture certainly has. With that, I stand for any questions from you or from any of the members.
Chairman Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner. With the budget that has been signed into law, and we're glad your budget is signed into law, we would like to see a whole lot more signed into law. In that budget, are you reducing any of your staff in the department?
Yes, we are indeed, and we took that move proactively, and so we did a staff reduction with our 5% reduction already. So we've reduced our operating budget by $2 million over the biennium, plus another 10% reduction in our base. So, yes, we have seen staff reduction. We had 26 retirements, all but six have been refilled, so there are six positions there.
Commissioner, are you aware of the fact that what you've done already counts towards the 15% goal, which, in the case of the House bill, is a is a four-year goal.
You know, and I spent some time, Mr. Chairman, also in the legislature, and at that time, if a bill came after another bill, that's the bill we dealt with. And so if you're telling me that I don't need to be here today, that would be great with me. I'd be happy to go home. I know that we passed a bill. I know that we went to a signing ceremony in the governor's residence. We all came together.
And Commissioner, Mr. Chairman.
But I'm anticipating that this reduction, this 15% reduction in workforce, applies to all agencies across the board.
Well,
I hate to use the term across the board since that's a negative one today, so let me retract that.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, this illustrates the problem we're facing. You know, there's a presumption out there that this is on top of the reductions you've already made. Mm-hmm. That's not the intent of these bills that we have. And the other thing that presumes that each and every agency or department will suffer a 15% reduction. That is not the case. The 15% in the case of the House is over 4 years. A lot of it is due, we think, will happen as a result of normal attrition, early retirements, and the like. And there may be some departments that have much less than that in achieving this goal, and others may have to do more. It's not an across the board. It's a goal for all of state government is what it is. So, Commissioner, with all due respects, I hope you can understand that's why we get frustrated when we have people who should be in the know have a very different impression of what it is we're trying to do.
Commissioner? Well, maybe this would be a good – would you – maybe, Mr. Chairman, just tell me what you'd have me do as the Commissioner of Agriculture. What should I do? We've passed a bill. It was signed into law. What more shall we do at the Department of Agriculture in all earnestness?
Representative Lamb.
What do you want me to do with the language that you have on the table?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, you can already start the work on what's been passed and signed into law.
We have done that,
that's
Mr. Chairman.
That's a given. And we're going to have to wait to see what comes out of this whole process to see what else you may need to do. But don't presume, because it's not true, that you're going to be expected to find another 15% reduction or that it is going to be 15% if there is further reduction. So, Commissioner, I guess you have to sort of wait and see what finally comes out of here. But my advice to you would be thinking about any contingency plans that you may have to look at implementing once we settle this budget for Minnesota.
So, Mr. Chairman, then, shall I assume that our budget is not resolved, even though we went through a process that was fairly well spelled out?
Representative Lamb.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, your budget is resolved in what's been signed into law, but there may be subsequent laws signed into law that would require additional activity or work on the part of the department. At this point, we don't know what it is. And what I'm saying is don't presume that the cuts you've already made aren't going to count, because they are. And don't presume that it's going to be 15%. It could be different. It all depends on where we end up. So,
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, would the chairs of those committees have those targets when we started negotiating the budget? They did not?
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Lanning.
Would you repeat your question?
I'm assuming that when we sat down to negotiate the ag budget, that the chairs, indeed, of the two committees had the targets.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, they had, yes, all of the committees had targets. We had targets. And your ag committees met their targets.
We did.
And it was signed into law.
Correct.
But I'm saying that additional action by the legislature could result in other actions that will be required. And we can't say at this point what that will be. I see Commissioner Showalter agreeing with my Commissioner, am I correct?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative, we, I think, are saying the same thing, that ultimately, there's instructions in the state government bill that may have a significant impact on the Department of Agriculture. That would include a four-year target for reducing the workforce by 15% of all funds. There may have been some progress towards that even today, but ultimately we're talking about a four-year reduction of about 15%. And as you said before, it sort of suggested that there was some confusion over the 15%. Is essentially that right away, the House position, and it's what's being debated, would be that there would be a 12% reduction in this current biennium from wherever the baseline is, and about we don't know, it's open-ended on the Senate side. We're assuming at least getting halfway. But either way, there's going to be significant impacts on the Agriculture Department with its bill closed, as well as other committees that had their bills open at this point.
Commissioner, the point I would add, Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Yes.
The point I would add is that the start date from the House position, and I guess we agreed to that the other day, is January 1. So whatever the employee count was, January 1 of 2011 is the baseline for any reductions that will be expected. So thank you, Mr. Chairman, for that. I thought that a clarification was important.
Thank you. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I had essentially the same line of questions, and I continue hearing it. And maybe my question for Mr. Fredrickson is, was the assumed 15% additional reduction something you gleaned or inferred from the reading of our state government finance bill, or where did that information come from that you were acting on that said you had an additional 15% to deal with?
It came, yes, it came from the bill. Apparently, I misread it then.
Representative,
is that your assumption?
Mr. Chairman,
on page R56. Reduction of state workforce, early retirement program. Number of full time equivalent employees.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner Fredrickson, and to everybody, I think the confusion here, and I'm just absolutely shocked that there is this confusion, and there may be some differences between the Senate bill and the House bill, but the 15% workforce reductions were, with the exception of $94,875,000 in the House bill, were entirely considered from a budgetary standpoint in the agency bills and their targets. The additional discretionary dollar amount that needs to get there for the entire 15% to be real, or the 12% in this biennium to be realized, is contained up on R19, and maybe that's where the confusion is. We went through this a lot during the committee process, and so anybody telling anybody that there's a 15% reduction or a 10% reduction off the top of their existing agency budgets, I don't think understands the interactions of these bills, and I grant you that it's complicated, and we decided to carry $94 million of that in our bill, and I know the administration is assuming that we're not going to realize some of the compliance revenues and some other things, and so they've come up with their own number, which we would disagree with, which is just part of negotiations. But I just cannot stress enough that the confusion generated by comments made that we are adding another 15% reduction on top of the agency budgets that are part of our budget resolution has to stop. And the public commentary and the political rhetoric telling us that we don't know how to balance our budget and that we're whacking people on top of the existing agency appropriations, maybe we just need to lock ourselves in a room with the commissioners and walk through the interactions of these. That would have been preferable to the public political commentary, and now the assertions being made here in public testimony. But we've got to get past this and start dealing with reality. I think I heard the other commissioner talk about a 10% reduction as though it was like a 10% agency reduction, and I was trying to do some quick math to figure out how that was even possible. But anyway, I think we need to have a little more light than heat in terms of the rhetoric, and maybe we need to go into recess or something and sit in a closed room and make sure everybody's on the same field. And if I'm wrong on some assumptions, I'm glad to be corrected too. But boy, we're making all kinds of statements that are generating a lot of concern for a lot of people that I don't think are an accurate reflection of our bill.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, a locked door and a quart of whiskey and throw the cork away might get it resolved. You might,
yeah. Commissioner Showalter.
Mr. Chair, thank you. If I could just respond, I think we're covering some ground that we discussed earlier in this hearing, which is that the two provisions have different bases, that the 10% reduction is to the general funds, the 15% is an all funds workforce reduction. So they are different provisions, and ultimately you have a significant workforce impact, and the language there is pretty clear about the overall target from January 1, 2011.
Any further questions of the Ag Commissioner? Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Shalito.
Chair Perry, Representative Lanning, my name is Larry Shalito, Commissioner of Veterans Affairs. First of all, listening to the discussion, it appears that our agency is the poster child for a lot of this discussion. And to that, to the committee, I apologize. That is not the intent. The clarification as to what's 15% and what's 10% will give us a lot of homework and a lot of things to do. However, having said that, I think it's imperative, as you see from all the representation here in the room, that this is a very significant issue. But I want to give it to you on a business perspective rather than a social perspective. I have 1,129 employees, not FTEs, employees. The homes generate 1,039 of them. The programs, 90. So when you talk about Veterans Affairs, it's imperative because about 4 years ago, you gave to the Department of Veterans Affairs the then turmoil of all the veterans' homes in the state of Minnesota. Gil Acevedo is here. We hired him from California. He has brought that back where we got three of the four homes getting ready to be profitable, if that makes a sense. Well, we can explain that, so forth. So when we talk about cuts, irregardless of what they are, the homes are going to be affected. So I will stand by that letter that was sent to the governor that homes will have to be looked at very, very seriously. Then when you deal with that, then you also have to realize that when you invest in a veteran's home, you make a 20-year decision. And there are tails to that construction that would have to be paid back to the federal government. Therefore, I now inherit another unrealized cost in doing something like that to meet the goals and objectives. Then we take a look at those 90 people. And I want to, again, have you take a look at the hats in the room. They have been your free employees for a great number of years. The American Legion, the VFW, are very much involved in identifying, bringing to the county veteran service officers, and guiding and being pathfinders for people getting their GI benefits. 2000. Fort Snelling, Whipple Building, was averaging about 175 applications, or what we refer to as power attorneys, a month. 2005, it was 360 a month. January, they broke 900. The argument that I will make to this committee is the war is just the earthquake and the tsunami is hitting. We are a special cause, special purpose entity for the state to maximize the number of federal dollars that come into the state of Minnesota. I was in Becker County yesterday. County Veteran Service Officer said they bring in $18 million to Becker County. Douglas County, my home county, $11 million. The VA is generating over $800 million into this area, taking care of the veterans. All of those people and the processing and the paperwork that is being done enables those people to get that hand up rather than handout that would have to come through the state. Minnesota is still a net taxpayer on the federal level, and we're just bringing those back in. So other than there's a lot of things listed in the newspaper article, and Representative Lanning, I'm sorry, you got the ambush. And a lot of those things are nickel-dime loss leaders. The big-ticket items are veterans' homes, and then after that would have to be the program and services themselves, which generate in cash flow into the state of Minnesota. So not all of us commissioners have the same shoes or the same size of shoes that we'll be careful to. You trained us well. One size doesn't fit all, but I just think it's imperative that you know it. And I will just close and leave it at that, subject to your questions.
Commissioner, I'll start out. Where in the Senate side have you found that we have not held you harmless?
The Senate, sir, you have been good to the veterans in the state of Minnesota. The Senate side is our preferred language. Page 56 is the one that gets me most confused. The 10%, 9% general fund. That's probably 19. I'm not sure exactly which
one.
That's
the earlier one, 19.
Yeah, that's 19. So other than that, that's where we are concerned. I hope that answers your question, sir. While you're discussing, sir, request permission for an alibi. An alibi is, I'd like to add some more information.
Well, Commissioner, before that, you have to realize that we have given discretion to MMB. And I guess what concerns me is that the direction that the Senate has set of holding harmless because of the nature of the veterans, that anyone would go against our intent. I guess that's what bothers me here, that knowing where the Senate stance is, that the commissioner of MMB would target you for more cuts in your department.
Chair Perry, thank you. I'm not.
You don't have to, Commissioner. You don't have to answer that. It was a statement. I didn't ask you to answer it, but
I have to answer the questions that were posed to me. What would you do if? And that was my answer.
And Mr. Chair, if I may,
Commissioner Showalter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The figures that you see and the impacts that you see are on average. So even to your point, if the Commissioner of Management and Budget uses his or her discretion to put a lower cut on Veterans Affairs at some point in time, that means that somebody's unwittingly actually testifying that the effects of this provision are not as severe as they are about to be. We're basically talking about on average. So we're trying to present to you as a general purpose of what the impacts here are going to be. So even as we're looking at impacts in areas that we would not want to reduce either, you need to know that ultimately the level of reductions that are made here are sizable and that there's very little ability to shift some of these costs just because of the level of them. And ultimately, you are understating, and we are all understating, the impacts on some of the agencies who end up receiving whatever is redirected.
So, Commissioner, what you're saying is that the administration and the governor want us to leave veterans on the table for future cuts? Is that what you're telling us?
Mr. Chair, I'm telling you that this language has substantial impact on all elements of state government, and as it currently is construed, would be nearly impossible to implement without dramatic impacts in many, many different activities.
I'm not quite sure that I got the answer I was looking for, Commissioner. Are you saying that we should leave the veterans on the table, that the governor and the administration wants us to leave the veterans on the table for future cuts.
Mr. Chair, I'm not here to negotiate over the language. I'm trying to help provide information as to the overall impact on the language of the House and the Senate proposals at this point.
Senator Vandiver.
Senator Perry, I think what I'm hearing the commissioner saying is that due to the political sensitivity of the veterans, they are willing to throw them under the bus in order to make their broader point that they're being totally cut too extremely. And so regardless of which direction this committee or this legislature should go, that it sounds to me like their intent is to play political games, continue doing that, regardless of what the truth is.
Did you have some? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner General, you know I have the utmost respect for you. You're not only an outstanding soldier, but a very dedicated public servant, and we're very thankful for the service that you've given to this state. Commissioner, you know that in the House bill, as well as the Senate, Veterans Affairs, Military Affairs are the only budgets that were increased, the only ones increased. And it seems to me that that sends a pretty clear signal what our intent is, that both the House and the Senate want to protect veterans and military affairs. And there should be no mistake about that, because it's very clear. Everybody else has got cuts. If you take a look at intent further, on the House side, we're doing everything we can to protect nursing homes. And if you think that the House is intent on having veterans' facilities suffer consequences here that would be problematic, you're misunderstanding the intent. I think the intent of the House has been very clear. That's something we feel ought to be protected. And so I'm very, very disappointed that for whatever reason, you have been given apparently impressions about what's going on here that are not accurate, and have led to, I think, a very serious misunderstanding that we need to address. And if there are suggestions as to things that we can do to give more comfort here in stating our intent, I mean, I think our intent has been pretty clear, then let's talk about that. But let's not go scaring people into thinking that something is going to happen when, in fact, it's not likely to happen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner?
Chair Perry, Representative Lanning, I appreciate that, and I understand your frustration, but I would also then give you my viewpoint. Yes, you've given us a 3% increase in the omnibus bill, both sides. Thank you. That I understand. But my mission is to take care of the veterans in this room. So I go with only the language that I have, which is the omnibus bill as written. And as I look at it, I see the vagueness of the 15%. I see the vagueness of the 10%. And due diligence, my responsibility, because sitting in hearings, you mandate of the commissioners due diligence in taking care and managing your organization. I cannot get into your head and think what you're really thinking. I cannot get into the committee's head to really think what they're thinking. So I had to provide the, and you said it very eloquently, the worst case scenario. And again, I apologized for that. I don't like doing that. I value how you have treated the veterans in the past. I have worked with you for now my eighth year. And the legislature has treated the Guard and the veterans extremely well in holding them harmless. So I just leave it at that.
Representative Lanning.
We've known each other since high school.
That's correct, sir.
And a simple phone call, General Commissioner, maybe could have helped clear up some of the misunderstanding if you were lacking. And let this be a lesson to us all, that before we go spouting off in a public sort of way that maybe we go to the source or what we're concerned about and have some conversation about it. Enough said.
Well taken, sir.
Commissioner, I would, and I know Representative Downing, and there might be some other questions, but I do admire your position. I do know you're a soldier. And when soldiers are given orders, they carry them out to the fullest. And I admire you for doing that. My concern is, for all in here who are veterans, it's time that this administration quits using veterans as a political pawn. I don't think I have to say any more. Stop it. Representative Downey. Any further questions of Commissioner Shalito? Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, sir.
Commissioner Roy.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, committee members, I'm Tom Roy, Commissioner of Corrections for the state of Minnesota. I'm on a mission to provide the best corrections that I possibly can. I'm going to change the tone here a bit and give you some good news about Minnesota corrections and where we stand. I think this context is very important for you. Only one other state spends less of their general fund on corrections. That state is Alabama. 2.6% of our general fund is spent on corrections. The national average is 6.9%. Minnesota is 49th in incarceration rates of prison and jails. That's very, very good news. Having that few people locked up translates into a very positive budget. And a third statistic that should be very important to you in this discussion and in this context that we just heard, especially, only 5.2% of our state workforce is involved in corrections. Our neighbors in Wisconsin, 14%, with almost the same demographics. So what I'm suggesting to you is that Minnesota Corrections is postured very positively, and the good work that was done probably in this room 30 years ago in establishing sentencing guidelines and approving the Community Corrections Act put us in a position that is enviable amongst the states. I truly believe that corrections is delivered in this state. It's the best it can possibly be. I don't want to revisit the previous discussions. I'm certainly aware of all the descriptions of these budget bills, but my comments will clearly give you a feel just in the worst case scenario. And I'm very hopeful and I'm encouraged by your words that not all departments may be impacted similarly. The proposals between the Senate and the House in a worst-case situation would translate to about 300 to 500 employees, and the current bills about $90 million over the biennium. And just to set the stage and to let you know what that would translate to, a major prison in Minnesota is our Faribault facility with an annual operating budget of about $42 million. I don't want to use rhetoric that will be characterized as scaring. I just need to set the stage for what that amount of money buys the public. There are two ways to look at prison populations and prison population reductions, and that is either a mass release of prisoners, and I don't think anybody in this room is interested in that. Certainly public safety, especially considering that Minnesota locks up so few people already. The ones we do have locked up are very serious offenders with an average of 7 prior offenses. So any mass release of prisoners would be a very, very poor decision. We have as an essential part of our corrections function to improve people once they are in our facilities and once they are on our supervision in the communities. We have over 100,000 offenders under supervision in the community. That's a huge part and a very important part of our function. The other potential budget reduction area would be programming, and it's no surprise to any of us that sex offenders have been on the front page nearly every day, and I have had that word in front of me, those two words in front of me, almost every day since I've been in this chair. Sex offender programming is very, very important. Educational programming is very important. Chemical dependency treatment is extremely important, and budget reductions in any of those areas would significantly impact recidivism, and we believe the public safety of our communities. And I, knowing how aggressive your agenda is here and knowing how many people are behind me that need to speak, I am going to stop with those comments, but I just think it's very important to set the stage for you.
Thank you. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Commissioner Roy, is it?
Correct, Tom Roy.
Thank you. Thank you for your service. We haven't ever met, I don't think, in committee.
We have not.
I'm just curious. You mentioned a $90 million reduction, and I'm wondering where that number came from.
Commissioner Roy.
The Office of Management and Budget has calculated, pursuant to the previous discussions today, and provided those numbers to us as a worst-case scenario. Commissioner Showalter, I think, has addressed the calculation of those numbers, and that is what my discussion has been based on.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm just, I'm living a little bit in the House position or the House bill, and maybe there's some differences in the Senate bill, and I know the commissioner said they've done some extrapolations and some assumptions about savings and revenue that are in our bills that they couldn't realize, so I appreciate they may have been working off a different number. But I'm looking in the House bill, and we are expecting that the executive branch agencies would generate $94,875,000 in additional reductions that aren't already considered in our other omnibus finance bills, and yet you're talking about a $90 million reduction, and we just heard from Department of Veterans Affairs of over $10 million in reductions, and so we're already exceeding the target, and we've only talked to two of our, relatively speaking, smallest agencies. We haven't talked to Human Services or any of the big monsters. And so, members, I just want to pull us back to the fact that these commissioners are relying on information that appears to be largely politically motivated to somehow extrapolate from these bills, which prescribe none of what is being communicated here. Nowhere in this bill is there a $90 million reduction to corrections. And so if you're getting your information from MMB or admin or wherever it comes from or the executive branch, I'm not sure how valuable this hearing is anymore, Mr. Chair. If every single number that's being presented and all of the draconian outcomes that are being represented are based on numbers that aren't even close to the provisions in this bill, and if we're going to continue with the hearing, I would like the testifiers to say that upon the governor's instruction and direction from the Office of Minnesota Management and Budget that we are going to make these cuts, that these are the governor's prerogatives, that these are his priorities and not ours, because they're nowhere in our bill. And we can sit here and continue to have the ongoing discussion with Mr. Showalter about how they were, you know, trying to come up with calculations and derivations from our bill to support these numbers. But members, I'm starting to tire of the discussion and constantly having to come back to the fact that it's not our bill that's driving these numbers. It's the governor's priorities. All of these numbers represent the governor's priorities, not our bills.
Thank you, Representative Downey. Commissioner Showalter, was there written instructions given to each commissioner on how to proceed for today's hearing?
Mr. Chair, I alerted commissioners, I believe, yesterday of the impact of the provisions that are in front of you on page R19, as well as the one later on the 15% reduction. We've been trying to understand the interaction and sort of the magnitude of that impact. We have been in communication with the fiscal staff over the last day trying to get their understanding and impact, understanding of the programmatic impact that we're trying to present to you today. In general, contrary to what Representative Downey, and I respect what he's saying, but the instructions are pretty clear in the bill as to the level of reductions, both in this provision and the other provisions. There are a few cost savings items, but in general, most of the savings that we're talking about are related to items that are reducing the staffing complement, reducing the available resources to commissioners to execute their responsibilities. So that is the spreadsheet that I talked about before to give you the overall context and the numbers that we're talking about here.
So, Commissioner, you did give written instructions so that they fully understood how they were to move forward with their testimony today?
Mr. Chair, I haven't instructed anybody on testimony. What I have asked and tried to inform them on is these provisions, because not everyone's always watching the State Government Committee, or at least trying to understand it. They're assuming we're taking the lead and looking at these elements and helping them to understand sort of what are the impacts and what are the issues that they need to be aware of. What we've asked.
So was it orally delivered, your message, or in writing form of the information that they're working off from? I guess what I'm looking for, Commissioner Showalter, okay. I would like to, if there was a written memo given to each commissioner on how to look at their budget, I would be interested, and I'm sure this committee would be, to see that memo. Because if every commissioner is coming here with worst case scenarios, that is a far cry from what is inside the House and the Senate versions of this bill, as I listen. And so I guess maybe for us to fully understand what the commissioners are working off from, I would think that it would be prudent to give us, let us look at the instructions that you have given the commissioners to look at their budget and prepare. And I believe, Representative Downey, am I on the same wavelength as you? Is that what you were looking for?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the graciousness of the chairs, because, frankly, I'm not feeling quite as gracious. I think it would be extremely important for us to see whatever worksheets veterans and corrections and everybody else were working off of, and understand the assumptions and the interpretations of our bills from MMB. And frankly, I just think it needs to be plainly said, and I've said it before, and I'll probably stop saying it. I'm getting tired of having the same conversation, but it seems to me pretty obvious that the governor is far less interested in having substantive, collaborative discussions about how we understand these bills and how we translate them into a final budget solution that everybody can agree with, and is far more interested in hiding behind the smoke screen of problematic fiscal notes and all kinds of assumptions and interpretations, and far more interested in getting out politically and hammering on the legislature rhetorically. And we don't have very far to go, and I think it's past the time that we get off of the political rhetoric side of it and get onto the true hard work of negotiations and collaboration. I find this hearing to be less about our bill and far more about political messaging, and I don't know why we'd continue.
Commissioner Showalter.
Mr. Chair, just for reference, would be happy to walk through in detail with the committee, and in fact, at a staff level, is some of the assumptions and the work that we're doing was already communicated. So we would be happy to continue doing that so you understand exactly how we're seeing the bill and the impacts of that. It is, I don't think, actually a worst-case scenario. I believe, based upon our interpretation, there are some interpretations here that probably mitigate some of the possible impacts on agencies. What we can't say centrally is what happens programmatically. Ultimately, that is what we've asked agencies to help
understand the magnitude of this impact above and beyond what is being discussed in other committees.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner, I'd like to formally request that any communication that you sent out here of late in preparation of this, that you submit that to us so we can see what you've told people.
Sure.
Thank you.
Do you any further questions for Commissioner Roy? Thank you, Commissioner.
Yeah.
Deputy Commissioner Arsenal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. On behalf of Commissioner Sorrell, I'd like to share just a few thoughts regarding this bill and its relationship to MnDOT. First, I'd like to just give a little brief background. As stewards of the transportation system for the people of Minnesota, we are continuously looking at more effective ways of delivering a safe, efficient, and sustainable transportation system. Over the past 10 to 15 years, we've been developing and utilizing performance measures as a management method to understand our ability to deliver smartly those products and services that we're responsible for. We regularly reach out to the public to understand their needs and how they relate to the transportation system. And we use that information to identify low-cost, high-benefit solutions that meet their needs. We do this through multiple partnership ventures with local governments and others. And our system is a very large system. It's about 12,000 miles, and it reaches out across the state. That type of a system requires a distribution of our workforce across the state of Minnesota to meet the needs of managing and maintaining the transportation system. Now, we looked at the bill, and we are about – what I would like to just share with you is a few areas where give an example of a 15% cut in our workforce and what impacts that might have. And, of course, we are in the process of looking through our risks and organizational risk management to understand better where exactly these ultimate reductions will occur. But I would like to go through just some examples of a 15% cut for MnDOT. That would amount to about 748 employees across the department. These employees, of course, are in a wide variety of different positions. For example, if you look at just our construction-related activities, these are the people that design and inspect the construction work that you see out on the road so much in the summer. That would be 264 fewer individuals doing that. Now, part of their job is to ensure that the people of Minnesota get what they're paying for through those contracts to deliver those roadways and make sure that those roadways are constructed, roadways and bridges are constructed in a proper way. If you look at our maintenance staff, these are the folks that do snow and ice and do the summer maintenance, pothole patching, doing clear zone drainage work, things like that, guardrail repair. Again, a 15% cut would be in the neighborhood of just under 300 people. If you look at our financial administrative support services, now these are the folks that process hundreds of invoices covering hundreds of millions of dollars of work, including, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars for local government through our state aid office. We're looking at in the neighborhood of 90 fewer employees in that area. And that, again, you know, as required by all of us to ensure that we're properly managing those resources and delivering a product appropriate to those expenditures for the public. If we look at our bridge-related, now, again, these are examples, and I can assure you that in the bridge area we wouldn't do this, and so it may have little value, but it would amount to 27 or so of our bridge inspectors. So, I mean, as you look across this 15%, you know, those 27 would have to come out of other areas and would increase the impact in those areas. And then there's a multitude of other things that include things like motor carrier, permitting and audits, our state aid office, our radio and electronic communications, which manages and maintains the 800 megahertz system that allows governments to speak you know, in emergency situations across government authority lines. That would be about 84 individuals in that area. So there is a significant impact of a 15% reduction for MnDOT, and I would open to any questions that the committee may have.
Committee have any questions for Commissioner Arsenal? Representative Downey.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of quick questions. We saw the 2010 workforce report, and I'm curious what kind of an annual retirement rate or number that you have in your workforce.
Commissioner Arsenal.
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, on a typical year, it's in the neighborhood of about 200 people per year. And, of course, those are across all different areas, technical, administrative, accounting, all kinds of areas.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, and separate question, in addition to retirements, what additional natural attrition do you have in the department?
Commissioner Arsenal.
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, you know, I'm sure that we can get that for you, but I'm not prepared at this moment. You know, clearly there are people that leave state government. I don't have that number for you right now, but we can get it for you.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And then Assistant Commissioner, I know in the workforce report we see kind of aggregate numbers in terms of the overall cost of compensation for our workforce, and it's a combination of wages and benefits. And I think I'm remembering this right. I don't have the document in front of me, but I believe in 2007 it increased 4% in executive branch agencies. 2008, 7%, 2009, 4%, and 2010, I may have these numbers wrong, 1%. But anyway, would your agency have more or less kind of mirrored the overall executive branch complex in terms of overall total costs of wages and benefits?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, I'm sorry, but I can't say that for sure. I do know that we track that very closely. But I don't have that information with me today.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And what percentage of your workforce would be in one of the major collective bargaining units? Is almost everybody, or do you have other folks that aren't?
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, our workforce, because of the nature of managing and maintaining the transportation system, consists of a lot of AFSCME employees. And I would say it is certainly the lion's share of our workforce. It's more than half and approaching two-thirds in that neighborhood. But, again, we can get you that information.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I was just looking at the collective bargaining agreements earlier today for a different reason. And statewide AFSCME Council 5 in the last biennium had a total 2.1% increase. I don't know, Unit 25, which is radio communications folks, was a 2.04% increase. So that seems to be on the high end of the overall 1% increase in state employees. So I'm guessing you'll probably be somewhere in there. And I just want to make the point, again, to members and the public. You know, when we laid out a 15% workforce reduction over a four-year period, The hope and intent is that as we get better, faster, smarter, cheaper at doing things, that we could leverage natural attrition, natural retirements, supplement that where necessary with early retirement incentives, and do it in a balanced and strategic way. And we very intentionally provided the flexibility to the governor to try and apportion that flexibly and strategically and intentionally and by design to the different functions and programs in state government. And I think your numbers in terms of retirements and attrition would probably bear out that that assumption or that kind of going in approach. And I just want to make sure folks realize that a 15% reduction over a four-year period, if done well and as an incentive to try and make the improvements and gain the efficiencies and find out where we're redundant across state government or where we're redundant with county and local governments, that this is not a draconian plan, that it's one where I hope we've got enough flexibility designed into it for the governor to make good decisions. And I think a lot of your kind of focus on just the headcount reduction side was helpful for me to see that we probably aren't wildly off base. Now, you may argue back, boy, there's just a mission that we have to accomplish and those reductions are too tight or something, and we could have that conversation. But I just want members to realize that 15% over 4 years is not an outrageous set of assumptions, and I think we'd have good common ground for working together going forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, you know, over the past several years, and without question, we have looked to streamline and build in efficiencies wherever we can, and we think we've done that. In years past, we used to have two people per plow. We don't have that anymore. In years past, we used to have business managers for all the offices. We don't have that anymore. We've consolidated. What we do have, though, is a 12,000-mile transportation system that requires bodies when it snows, and when we're doing construction projects on those roads, it requires bodies and people to ensure that those expenditures that we're making through the construction program are providing the citizens with what they're paying for. And so, and the last point I would make is that attrition it may or may not align with the needs of the agency in terms of technical versus administrative and other things. You know, I would think it would be unlikely that we would have attrition rates, you know, exactly that would meet the needs of a reduction such as this. But
any further questions for Deputy Commissioner Arsenault? Thank you. Committee members, I guess I'm going to kind of change a little bit. I believe I saw Deputy Chief of Staff of Legislative Affairs of the Governor's Office here, and I'm thinking I would like to ask Michelle Kelmhelken to step to the table. Welcome.
Thank you.
Deputy Chief of Staff, I guess we've heard a lot of testimony here today, and I'm just trying to get a handle. Maybe you could help us out here on the governor's position on the omnibus bill at this point.
Well, you'd have to ask the governor his position on the bill specifically. He obviously has put forward a state government bill that he supports. And I guess at this point that would be his position.
Representative Lanning.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is it still the governor's position that that he does not want to negotiate any provisions of our bills until all bills are on his desk?
Ms. Kelmhelden.
What the governor said again this morning, I can repeat because he said it publicly with the press, that it was important that the House and the Senate establish a position that then could be compared to his position, which he put out February 15th in his budget. And once the two positions are very clear and the legislature has one position, then he could begin negotiating on the bill. And he'd like that to be balanced and the numbers to be verified.
Mr. Chairman, does the governor understand that taking that approach is going to delay resolution of this budget?
Ms. Kamhauer.
Again, I can't speak for the governor. I would assume that he certainly feels strongly about his position and that that's the best way to come to resolution. But I can't speak on his behalf as to what he understands or doesn't understand or thinks or doesn't think. I wouldn't want to presume to speak for him.
Ms. Kelmhelgen, is it the governor's position that the commissioners should be here presenting the worst-case scenario to this committee?
Again, I want to be careful not to speak for the governor. He clearly speaks for himself. I think that in general, our office, our commissioners all feel strongly that it's important that this committee and the public understand what the potential implications would be of the state government bill in particular. I think all the agencies speak in their individual policy and budget committees about the impact of the bill, but the state government bill obviously has broad-ranging implications for all our agencies, and sometimes it's not very clear as to how it impacts the individual agencies, and I think that's important that everyone understand that.
Ms. Kelmhelgen, do you believe that it's by presenting? I guess I'm still concerned about the presenting of a worst-case scenario, because right out of the chute, it incites public fear. It puts people in a state of anxiousness. And do you believe that that's the correct way that we should be moving forward here, or do you believe the governor believes that's the way we should be moving forward here?
Well, just, again, speaking for myself as the policy director, I think it's very important. First of all, these are not worst-case scenarios. These are on average. I mean, I have sat through this, and I've listened to people say that the intention was not to cut agriculture. The intention was not to cut corrections. The intention was not to cut veterans nor military affairs. But someone will be cut. There are very real cuts in that bill. And until you change the language of that bill, that's what we have to assume is going to be happening. And someone will get cut. I mean, there are going to be cuts, but if you intended them to be in different places and not broad cuts to our agencies, which is what your bills say, then I think you need to clarify that.
Representative Benson.
You know, we started with, thank you, Chair, a long discussion because of the issues with the veterans. But I have the comparative spreadsheets. And as I look through them, and I'm just speaking to the House numbers now, they're exactly the governor's numbers. So I'm wondering that when you made a presentation of the governor's numbers, did you provide a worst-case scenario to the Commissioner of Veterans Affairs?
We didn't have those cuts to the agencies in the state government bill. We had individual agency cuts in all of the budget bills, in the individual agency budget bills, but we did not have the overall cuts to all the agencies, the 15% as well as the broader 10% across agencies. We didn't include that in our budgets.
Representative Benson.
Well, I'm just looking at the appropriation. You know, that's what I'm looking at. So I'm looking at the amount of money that the House is in their budget at least saying that veterans are going to get, and the amount of money that the governor says. And I know we're talking about the language regarding cuts, but I'd like to know whether or not, indeed, if a worst-case scenario as far as budget projections with revenue, if any additional language from the governor's office to the commissioners came out regarding do you need a contingency?
Ms. Kelmhelgen?
You mentioned veterans. The governor had no cuts to veterans or military affairs. And we did not have the overall cuts to the agency. So there is no contingency or overall cut number that would be required for that.
Representative Downey.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask a question, but I'll just make a statement, and maybe we can just move on from there. But so we just heard that the governor is not interested in discussing anything with us until we have a joint Senate and House conference committee position. And yet here we have every single commissioner coming in with some kind of interpretation of the House and Senate positions. And I don't know that we're negotiating or what we're doing here, but there's a huge disconnect in my mind. If the governor wants to wait before negotiating with us or having any kind of further discussions about this bill until we have a joint Senate and House position, then I'm not quite sure why he's negotiating internally and out in the public at the microphone. I'm not sure with himself or whom. But those two things don't add up. And, Mr. Chair, again, I'll just ask. I'm not going to make a motion to adjourn. I just question the validity or even the purpose of this hearing. If the governor wants to wait until we have a joint position, then let's wait until we have a joint position, and then he'll have something to react to. But saying that out of one side of your mouth and then coming up with all these interpretations of the bills as they exist today, that just doesn't add up. So, I'll defer to the chair in terms of the utility of proceeding, but I'm not quite sure why we're here.
Senator Vandiver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have a question about the process that's being proposed. I don't know if Senate staff or counsel or somebody who could tell us, typically when in these scenarios, is the bill closed up or is the conference committee's work done before they deal with the governor? Is that typically how this is done?
I'm not.
Historically, I guess, might be the question.
Historically speaking, I don't. I for one, can't. Can anyone, counsel, make any comment towards that?
Mr. Chair Lanning?
Mr. Shepard, do you have any? Or Mr. Bodern? All right. Well, I think that's the answer. Committee members, here's the way we're going to proceed. Commissioner Showalter, Representative Lanning asked you to produce some documents.
Yep.
I would like to see if you could produce them as quickly as possible. We are going to take a recess until 4 o'clock, and as quick as you can get us that information, because that information will help us to determine whether or not I believe we need to continue with this hearing.
Sure.
Thank you. This committee meeting is in recess until 4 o'clock. All right.